From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, Africa and Great Power Competition. Our guest, none other than J. Peter Pham, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, that's a think tank based in Washington. No stranger to these microphones, Peter Pham served as the first ever U.S. Special Envoy for the Sahel region of Africa with the personal rank of ambassador from 2020 to 2021. According to his bio on the American Academy of Diplomacy website, this position was created to coordinate U.S. strategy on the cross-border security, political, economic, and social issues arising in the Sahel. Previously, Peter Pham served as the U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa from 2018 to 2020. And prior to serving in the Trump administration, Pham was Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives at the Atlantic Council in Washington and Director of the Council's Africa Center. In that role, he appeared at least a dozen times on our sister program, Encounter. He also served as Vice President of the Association for the Study of the Middle East and Africa, and that's an academic organization which represents more than 1,000 scholars of Middle Eastern and African studies at hundreds of colleges and universities in the United States. And Pham is currently a distinguished fellow, as I said, at the Atlantic Council. And Ambassador J. Peter Pham joins us via Microsoft Teams to discuss all things Africa-related. Peter, welcome to the program.
Carol, it's wonderful to be with you.
It's certainly great to have you back at these microphones, Peter. So this is such a delight for me. And as I said to my audience on another program, I will be retiring at the end of this month. So it's really a treat and a privilege to have you on this show. Well, let's begin with some hot button issues, Peter, and then segue into the bigger issues over which you presided in the last administration and which you've been covering for decades. Let's talk about Russia's tentacles in Africa, particularly via the Wagner Group recently had a failed mutiny in Moscow. We know about the longstanding ties between many African nations and the former USSR via the liberation movements during the Cold War. But Peter, how do you account for continued, I would call it ambivalence by some, like South Africa, a democracy, vis-a-vis Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, annexation of Crimea? Where's the outrage?
Carol, before I start, let me begin by thanking you for having me on and also to really commend you and congratulate you. You'll be missed at these microphones, and certainly many of us are grateful for the attention you've always given to Africa among many other issues around the globe, but giving a place for Africa to have its issues, its concerns, and its challenges discussed on these mics. So it's been great to be part of that story some of the time. With regard to Russia and the ambivalence, as you characterized, of many African countries. Part of it, I think, is attributable to the desire on African leaders, and I think correctly so in this regard, of not being drawn into a competition between great powers. They experienced that during the Cold War when the United States and its allies on one side, the Soviet Union and its allies on the other, and to a certain extent, more limited extent, Communist China as well, engaged with different actors. And there was a Cold War across Africa and some places that even became a hot war. So there's that historical experience. But I think more than that, if we're being very honest, it also comes down to individual interests, which sometimes trump, unfortunately, in African diplomacy, trump national or continent-wide interests. And, you know, at the beginning of the most recent Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, there was certainly a moment at the very beginning when Ambassador Martin Kimani, Kenya's permanent representative to the United Nations, which was serving at that time Kenya on the UN Security Council, gave a very impassioned and, in fact, arguably the most eloquent speech in the Security Council debate on condemning that invasion. Unfortunately, Ambassador Kimani didn't have many following him, and we've seen the sorry situation in particular of countries like, as you mentioned, South Africa, which has not only failed to stand up for international law and order, but in fact has been credibly accused by journalists, investigators, and in fact even the United States ambassador to South Africa of not only condoning, but actually providing weapons to the Russian aggressor. And the only explanation that's actually makes sense in all that is that individual members of the regime and of elites in South Africa, as well as the African National Congress, the ANC, the ruling party, benefit. It's no secret, in fact, its own declarations, legal declarations, that the largest single donor to the ANC is actually a sanctioned Russian oligarch. I certainly don't accept the explanation that this is revolutionary solidarity from the liberation struggle, especially when one looks at the hard data that more than half of the degrees awarded to South Africans during the liberation period from the former Soviet Union were awarded by Ukrainian institutions. And almost all of the military training that the ANC received was actually in Ukrainian territory in Crimea, back when it was part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. So if there's gratitude to be had, a lot of it is actually owed to Ukraine. So I think there are other explanations that I think are truer to reality.
Very interesting observation about that with respect to Ukraine and, of course, the individual interests. And I remember well Ambassador Kamani's speech at the UN. But let's turn now to the BRICS summit. We're talking about Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa coming up in South Africa in August. You know, we know that, of course, there's an arrest warrant for Putin, the ICC, International Criminal Court, for the war crime of illegally deporting children from Ukraine. And finally, we see that South Africa says that they've agreed that Vladimir Putin will stay away from the BRICS summit because they are not prepared to arrest him. Talk about how that developed and what you see coming out of that summit.
Well, the BRICS are sort of an anomalous grouping in the international community. It's almost like you're back in high school and, you know, it's the nerds club or the outcasts banding together. These are countries that didn't fit into any of the other great groupings, the G7, the seven largest economies in the world, Russia having gotten itself kicked out of what was once the G8 after its invasion and illegal annexation of Crimea. China never having been part of that leading grouping. These were countries that didn't have a place, and so they created their own place. It's interesting, the term BRICS was actually coined by a Wall Street banker, an American, to describe simply the economies that would have large impacts on the 21st century. Certainly right about India and China. Not sure that banker is necessarily right about Russia, which is a basket case, nor Brazil, much less South Africa, where a number of factors is leading to its overall decline economically. But this is the club. It's a club whose members do not necessarily have congruent interests. India and China, for example, have at times a violent border dispute that occasionally breaks into conflict. And in fact, many Western military planners and strategists look to India as an ally in the Indo-Pacific area against China. So this is not one that's lying. Now, three of them in particular, Russia, China, and South Africa, have made close comity. And in fact, this year held a joint military exercise timed, not uncoincidentally, on the anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. A bit of poor taste in my view. But so it's a group, but its interests are limited as a whole. Vladimir Putin, yes, there's the question of the International Criminal Court, the ICC's arrest warrant for him, as you mentioned, but South Africa has not in the past paid great attention to this. We remember a few years ago when Omar al-Bashir, then the dictator of Sudan, who was under a ICC indictment for war crimes, came to South Africa. The government did nothing to arrest him. A number of civil society organizations brought a lawsuit in South African courts, and the courts in South Africa ruled that the government was obliged to respect its treaty obligations. But rather than acquiesce to the court rulings, they actually defied them and packed Mr. Bashir off onto his plane and out of the country. So there's no real track record of South Africa honoring its treaty obligations. So I don't think there was a danger. Furthermore, after the Wagner mutiny and march on Moscow, and the ensuing suspicions cast and commanders fired or disappeared or under house arrest, highly unlikely that Vladimir Putin would leave Russia, much less leave it for a country as far away as South Africa. I don't think that was ever in the cards. So his non-attendance certainly saves South Africa additional embarrassment, but I wouldn't attribute it to any great diplomacy, more like realpolitik in the Kremlin.
Indeed. Well, you mentioned Omar al-Bashir, so let's move right now to Sudan. We have done many programs on this very unfortunate conflict. So, Peter, let's talk about if there's any light at the end of the tunnel for the long-suffering people of Sudan who toppled dictator Omar al-Bashir only to see their country descend again into civil war. Where do we stand right now? Do you see any negotiations going on? What are the Gulf countries doing? Are they actually fueling either party, that is the RSF, Rapid Support Forces, or the Sudan Armed Forces? What is the state of play?
Well, I agree with you, Carol, that this is a tragedy. The hopes and dreams of so many Sudanese for a better future seemingly dashed on the ambitions of two military commanders, General Burhan, the head of the Sudan Armed Forces, the conventional military, and General Dagalo, better known as Hemeti, the head of the RSF, which descends from the Janjaweed, the irregular forces responsible for the genocide in Darfur 20 years ago. And unfortunately, both sides are relatively evenly matched. The Sudan Armed Forces have air power, which gives them a certain dominance. On the other hand, they don't have sufficient numbers to dominate the entire national territory, leaving the periphery, where the RSF are stronger, to essentially those irregulars. So with the balance of forces between them, resources between them, there's not an easy solution to this. And unfortunately, that's not only caused 3 million people to become displaced within Sudan, it sent refugee flows into neighboring countries, all of which have their own issues with stability and challenges, including Chad to the west, South Sudan to the south, Ethiopia to the southeast, Egypt to the north, although Egypt is at peace, certainly has enough financial pressures of its own. So this is complicating the picture throughout the Horn region. And part of the blame I would lay for this, certainly the primary responsibility are the two warring factions, but part of the blame I would also lay on a bit of wishful thinking on the part of Sudan's outside partners. While Bashir's overthrow was accomplished in the context of months-long protests by ordinary Sudanese, one can't forget that at the end of the day, it wasn't the protests that ousted Bashir. It was his military and RSF commanders who decided that he had become too much of a liability. So it was a palace coup taking place in the context of protests. And in fact, we can't forget that shortly after that, the RSF turned on the protesters. So it was never quite a revolution in the true sense of a revolution. And yet, I think many international actors, putting the best spin on it, acted as if a real transition had occurred, when all that happened had been a switch in horses, so to speak, on the same wagon of state that had been trudging through the last few decades.
That's a fascinating analysis, J. Peter Fung. But very quickly, before we go to a break, in your view, does anybody have the political will, any of the countries in the Gulf, or does the U.S. have any leverage? I mean, where's the leverage to stop the carnage and to get back to some stable situation in Sudan?
So certainly some of the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, which has played a very key role in recent weeks, along with the United States, in hosting ceasefire talks, although the ceasefires have not lasted, has a role. But then the United Arab Emirates has also a role. And unfortunately, it appears that, although there's a little bit of hedging on both sides, that the UAE and Saudi Arabia have ended up on two different sides of the Sudanese civil war. That's an oversimplification, but in broad strokes, that's what has occurred. And therefore, in a way, the conflict is also a proxy conflict to a rivalry within the Gulf for primacy, if you will, in driving the agenda of those kingdoms. So unfortunately, once again, Sudan is not entirely an independent actor, and that's part of the tragedy.
Exactly. So the UAE evidently backing the RSF, and then you're saying Saudi Arabia backing the Sudan Armed Forces?
Roughly. There are some nuances, and there are specific cases one could get into the weeds of the UAE, parts of the UAE hedging their bets. But quite frankly, you know, the U.S. has leveled sanctions on both sides, but Hemeti operates businesses out openly in Dubai, and that can't be ignored.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is J. Peter Fung. He's a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. Previously, he served as special envoy for the Sahel and Great Lakes regions of Africa under the Trump administration. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to two of our most loyal listeners and Facebook fans, Ibrahim Abba from the great state of Nigeria and Tony Zola in Thailand. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page, because as I said, I will be retiring at the end of the month after 24 years of very gratifying broadcasting here at the Voice of America. Well, back to our terrific guest, J. Peter Pham. And Peter, so much to talk about. But since you mentioned Hemeti and the RSF doing business in Dubai, speaking of mercenary type groups, let's go back to Russia. Let's go back to the Wagner Group. And there, what I guess many people would characterize as rather malign activities in like Mali and CAR. What is the situation? How active is the Wagner Group in these Sahelian countries? How dangerous is their influence? How did it come to this in these countries?
Before I get into answering that, Carol, let me make two preliminary points. One is, it has long been a part of Russian foreign policy under Putin. And I wrote about this in a pair of book chapters 15 years ago when I started seeing the trend lines that Russia was back after a period at the collapse of the Soviet Union when Russia closed embassies and pulled out of Africa and called back its loans. It'd been looking for opportunities to return, but they had fewer resources to do that. And so they were looking opportunistically. And those two things have to be kept in mind. The Russian government's desire to gain back some of the influence that the old Soviet Union had, but on the other hand, the limited resources, and therefore trying to do it opportunistically. First opportunity for Wagner, of course, opened up in the Central African Republic, where the president needed security. There was an arms embargo, and France at the time was unwilling to provide the arms that President Touadera requested to protect himself within the capital. And so through a variety of things, Wagner was brought in to provide that protection, and bit by bit, they began filling out the state, so to speak, and their tentacles of influence extended beyond just physical protection of the president to providing strategic advisors, personnel in ministries, and taking over mining concessions, and one thing led to another. That model is essentially the model that's been going on. Where opportunity presents itself, they go in and then spread from there, like an ink blot, so to speak. Now, what's interesting right now, the answer we will have to wait, is what happens in the wake of the mutiny and the Russian state's attempt to take over Wagner, the military company. Because as a military company, a standalone, Wagner doesn't work in Africa. What makes it work are the whole network of several dozen companies that do everything from running liquor distribution to mining for gold to smuggling ore abroad to selling precious metals out of Dubai. All these fit together, and the cumulative profits are what make possible the military activities, which in turn permit the Russian state to have influence without being directly responsible. Now, you can see where this is leading, that a Russian takeover of Wagner may make sense and work in the conflict in Ukraine. But then taking over the mercenaries in Africa, they lose that deniability. And that comes at a political cost. Moreover, I'm not sure about the capabilities of the Russian state to manage a complex criminal enterprise, such as the many companies of Wagner. So it all remains to be seen if this is a house of cards that's collapsed or whether it's something on which there's a new chapter and a new threat. But what has been a threat is using their opportunism, going in and propping up people who seize power by military coups, providing fake news, misinformation, disinformation, and generally lowering governance and security rather than actually enhancing it.
That's certainly an understatement, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I would be remiss if we didn't talk about China and China's influence, which is growing, has been growing over the last decades in the continent with their Belt and Road Initiative. Also, an enormous amount of disinformation and basically infrastructure. Talk about where things stand with China and how much of a threat do you think it does pose for democracies, some of which are really backsliding, we see in Africa, and what the United States can or can't really do about it.
Well, I think we're at an inflection point, really, coming out of the pandemic. China has much more limited resources. The economic recovery in China, even if you accept at face value, which probably is not the most prudent thing in the world to do, if you accept at face value the official Chinese statistics, the recovery has been anemic, if it's even a recovery. So the resources available for the Grand Belt and Road issues of billions of dollars of debt by African countries piled up for infrastructure, I think the day for that model is over. China cannot afford it. Now, what is happening, though, is many of these countries are left in debt, and China has not been willing to forgive that debt as readily as other creditors. In fact, China delayed the debt resolution for Zambia and agreed to a deferral, but not to take a haircut on principal, the billions owed by that country, and therefore delayed for a long time. They finally agreed to at least a brief break in payments, but not a reduction in the principal. So the dangers of that are evident. For other countries, the real danger from this is not that Belt and Road will continue under its previous form, but in the meantime, China has acquired control of key strategic resources, many of which are absolutely critical to the energy transition, to any ambition for a net zero future. Good example, cobalt. Two-thirds of the world's cobalt is produced in one country, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And China controls every single major cobalt mine in the entire country. So just in DRC alone, two-thirds of the world's supply of cobalt. Of course, cobalt is critical to electric batteries and other components. Rare earths. China produces many of the rare earths in its own country. Geology has gifted them that way. But what they've done is acquired processing. Over 90% of the world's rare earths, which go into permanent magnets for everything from electric vehicles to wind turbines, have to be processed in China. So the risk for the international community and countries like the United States and our European friends, as well as Japan, South Korea, Australia, and others, is that the minerals we need for the technologies of today and tomorrow are increasingly locked up. It's the supply, the bottlenecks that China controls. Now, I think there is an opportunity for pushback, and I see a bit of that going on in places like Angola, the DRC, Zambia, where the United States is encouraging the building out of a regional corridor, not just for transport of critical minerals, but also for communication, regional integration, and trade, offering an alternative to Belt and Road, a modest first step, but an important one. And I think this is important because for us, de-risking, allowing African countries to capture more of the value chain is, for us and our friends and partners, the key to de-risking the stranglehold that China has on processing. You know, when one talks about the green economy or net zero future, it's absolutely absurd to think that we're going to lower our carbon emissions and achieve environmental sustainability by mining minerals in Africa, putting them on trucks, driving 1,000 miles to the coastline and putting them on boats to chug all the way to China for processing. That's not very green. The carbon footprint of just shipping the minerals for processing in China and allowing China to capture the value chain, as opposed to having the value chains captured in Africa, which would de-risk them for the United States and its allies. To me, it's night and day.
And you're saying that you see a shift in that direction?
I think slowly, but certainly the initiative that the U.S. and its G7 partners have encouraged through the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, PGII, coordinated out of the White House by Amos Hochstein, it's a first step. It's a modest first step, but it is a sea change from our usual approach. It's an integrated approach, and it emphasizes both African beneficiation and our interest in de-risking supply chains. So it's a refreshing approach to wringing our hands and saying the sky is falling because of China, or aid rather than trade. So I look upon it as a very refreshing step in the right direction.
Well, indeed. And that leads me to ask you about the Biden administration's push for re-engagement with the continent that started at least officially last year with the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit and a number of meetings and all kinds of proposals and projects that seem to flow from that. The trade agreement, like you said, the Continental Free Trade Agreement. Are you optimistic about this approach and the sustainability of it?
Well, I'm gratified by the attention paid on Africa, and I think we have to acknowledge that certainly in terms of high-level visits and engagements, the Biden administration has set a new, at least visits to the continent, a new temple. The vice president has been there. The president is scheduled to go later this year. Senior cabinet members, not just the secretary of state, but the secretary of the treasury. You know, in recent days, we've seen the chair of the U.S. Export Import Bank over there, the CEO of the Development Finance Corporation, and numerous other relatively senior officials traveled to Africa. All great and wonderful. The engagement is, that's a first step. But then there's the follow-up. There's the financing piece. And in that, the jury is still out on whether the bureaucracy is nimble enough to follow through. I can't help but notice, I mentioned a few moments ago, the PGII, the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment. And the announcement the White House made during the G7 summit in May was rather interesting. It listed a number of objectives. And then among things being done, there was a lot of due diligence being completed. The process is underway, all of which is a nice spin on, we actually haven't gotten the money out the door. And whether we can pick up speed and get that money out the door and actually get the promises kept, that's going to be great. I just returned from a 2.5-week trip across the continent to 4 different capitals, met with senior leaders and heads of state, and everyone appreciates the attention, but they're waiting for the follow-up and the actual delivery. And that's going to be critical.
Where do you think the holdup is, Peter? Does that have something to do with Congress by any chance?
No, I mean, there are cases where sometimes it is, but in some cases, Congress, for example, authorized the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, DFC, to have a capitalization of $60 billion. Think of DFC as a development, a bank. Imagine any bank where only less than half of the capital in the bank has actually been pushed out the door in terms of loans and financing, and the other half is sitting there literally gathering dust in the safe. No one would run a bank that way. But almost 5 years on from the establishment of the DFC, that's exactly what's happened. The money hasn't moved out the door. And that's not Congress's fault. Congress authorized the money. It's not been spent. And so I think there is a bureaucratic part of this. And, you know, one could do a whole show, and I realize we're coming to the end of our time. But I think that in a way, we're expecting development institutions to work like the private sector, but we don't incentivize them the way the private sector is incentivized. And there are some people, a small minority, who do it out of sheer devotion, but most humans respond to incentives.
Indeed. And you mentioned the Ex-Im Bank, and we actually featured Rita Jo Lewis on the program several months ago.
And I should be clear, Ex-Im is actually one of the institutions that actually, I think, is moving at a reasonable pace, unlike some others one could name.
Okay. Well, as you said, Peter, we are coming to a close. And I don't know if you want to highlight any maybe bright spots, talk about maybe your recent trip, some highlights or even dangers that we need to pay attention to with respect to the continent backsliding on democracy.
Well, since we're coming sadly to the end of your time at the mic here, Carol, that I think, you know, if we look back at these years, and I've had the privilege of sharing a number of them with you, Africa has changed. And for the large part, with ups and downs and unevenness, for the better. You know, our conversations over the years have been, you know, we still talk about crises and challenges and conflicts, increasingly about opportunity and the importance of the continent strategically, demographically. We all know the statistics, mid-century, 1 in 4 working age persons on the globe is going to be an African. How important the critical minerals in Africa are to the world's attempts to have an energy transition. How China is now resource stretched to the limit and unable to continue to buy up resources the way it has in the past. So there's a moment of opportunity here, both for Africa to assert itself and for the United States and its partners to truly engage. There's a desire for that. And the key is, and I hope that we move quickly enough and with enough strategic foresight that we seize the moment, because that window is not going to be open forever. And I truly believe this can be Africa's century, and certainly it can also be ours insofar as we are engaged in the African century. And there are a lot of things that align, like the value added in Africa on critical minerals would benefit us, de-risk our supply chains, and create thousands of jobs and economic opportunities for African countries. But the opportunity won't last forever. And I just hope we and they seize it together.
J. Peter Pham is a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, formerly special envoy for the Sahel and Great Lakes regions of Africa under the Trump administration. Peter, once again, thank you for this conversation. conversation. And thank you for joining me all these many years on both Encounter and Press Conference USA during my tenure at VOA.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for my last Press Conference USA. We will be featuring Congressman Don Bacon, a Republican from the state of Nebraska. That's next week on Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.